Hey everybody, welcome to episode 52 of Mind Shift Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. As you can no doubt tell, my voice is a little bit screwed up. I've had a pretty bad cold for about a week and a half now. Missed a few days off work. But I wanted to get this episode out to you because today's discussion features a really intriguing conversation with author and I guess you could say ex-pastor Chris Kratzer. And he's just come out with a brand new book called Leatherbound Terrorism: Crucified by Conservative Evangelicalism, Resurrected by Jesus. And I think that kind of encapsulates a small way Chris's own journey. Here's a guy who was a pastor of 21 years in conservative evangelicalism, and then what led him to walk away from it all, what happened. But what is so fascinating, I think, about Chris's story is that, okay, yeah, he's walked away from evangelicalism, and he is absolutely no friend of evangelicalism. In fact, just looking through his blog, which is at chriskratzer.com, just look at some of the post titles of his blog posts. One of them on January 8th, you can take your wall and your conservative evangelical privilege and suck it. Another one from November 27th, Trump supporting Christian, where the hell is your rage? Or one of my favorite ones, November 7th, no Christian, I'm not your spiritual bitch. And he's obviously no fan of evangelicalism. And we're going to get into exactly why Chris is not a fan of conservative evangelicalism, why he says he's been crucified, and what the metaphor of his book represents. What does he mean by leather-bound terrorism? It's obviously got to have something to do with the Bible itself being bound in leather and somehow maybe being used as a weapon of terror, a way to control people. And we're going to get into that in this episode today. But what's fascinating about it is, unlike so many ex-evangelicals, Chris hasn't abandoned the Christian faith entirely, but he's had a radical change of heart, a radical change of mind, become far more inclusive and open, and he's sharing what he calls a message of grace. And so he does still consider himself a Christian, albeit, I guess you would say, a very progressive Christian. He's certainly not a conservative evangelical anymore. And we're going to talk about what that means and how his views have changed from when he was a fundamentalist or an evangelical to where they are now. And what does that all mean? So I think it's interesting for someone, I don't know where you're at spiritually, but maybe you feel like I'm sick of evangelicalism too. I don't want to be a fundamentalist anymore. I've got a lot of problems with what's going on in the conservative church. And something that's come up lately, if you've been a fan on Twitter of someone like Chris Stroop, who was on this show, he came up with a hashtag not too long ago, which was a hashtag expose Christian schools. And that's caused a huge uproar. In fact, just the other day, conservative religious thinker, whatever you want to call him, Christian Matt Walsh, he was on Fox News complaining about this because it's become a whole story where Vice President Mike Pence, his wife, she took a job at a Christian school, and that became a huge story. And there's been this huge backlash, and it's been a thing on Twitter, a massive trend, this exposed Christian schools. And it's really showing what's going on in a lot of Christian schools across, certainly in America today. And it's kind of showing the ugly side, what's going on with these MAGA kids, you know, the Covington Catholic High School kids who were mocking the Native American man in Washington, D.C. lately, and all the stuff that's come out on both sides. That's become a partisan issue. And almost predictably, it's devolving down partisan lines, defending the kids or accusing the kids. And here again, now Christians are claiming that they are so persecuted. And Chris talks about, you look at some of those blog titles that I read earlier, you know, they seem very attacking and very vilifying of the conservative evangelical church. And he's gotten a lot of heat, a lot of pushback, like Chris Stroop has as well, for his seeming attacks on conservative Christianity. But then Chris will turn around and say, well, maybe it's not strong enough. Maybe I'm not being strong enough. So there's some really interesting stuff going on in this interview coming up with Chris Kratzer in just a few minutes. So I'm not sure, as I say, where you're at spiritually, but if you consider yourself a progressive Christian, but you're not a fan of conservative evangelicalism, then I think you'll enjoy Leatherbound Terrorism and at least getting to know a little bit more about Chris. One of the things I will say before we head into this interview in a minute is that when we did the recording, my internet here in North Wales is not very good. So the audio quality, it's as good as I can get it. Some of it is a little bit garbled. It might be kind of hard to understand, but I've edited it. I've tried to make it as clear and clean as I possibly can. So apologies in advance for any of the issues with the audio. But as we say, we're still running copper phone line broadband here in North Wales. That's how far behind the times we actually are in this country in some capacity. So we are still waiting for our high-speed fiber broadband internet. So blame the Welsh government, blame the British government. You can write an angry email to Theresa May, because I'm sure right now with what's going on with Brexit, I'm sure she doesn't have enough on her table. So you can complain to Theresa May and see how far that gets you. So I just wanted to say too, before we get into the chat with Chris, that I wanted to give a big shout out to some recent additions to our Mindshift Podcast Facebook group. Recently welcomed Lauren Danver, who's just become one of our newest Patreon supporters. In fact, if you want to support this show, that would be great. You can do that. The links are in the show notes, as always. Also from the Great White North, Susan Leppin, as well as Michelle Oney Snyder and Nancy Mano. So thanks everybody for jumping into the group. It's great to have you. Great to get to know you. All right, so let's go on into the discussion with Chris Kratzer. Let's talk about Leatherbound Terrorism and see what in the world that title is all about, hear his story, and figure out what's going on in the world of Chris Kratzer. All right, I'm joined by Chris Kratzer coming from North Carolina. How you doing, Chris? You doing okay today?
Good, Clint. Thank you. Yes, awesome.
Yeah, I'm glad we were able to finally connect up. We've been talking about getting together for a while now. We finally were able to set a day and a time. Yep. I'm really interested to get into your book, Leatherbound Terrorism. You're coming out of evangelicalism, though. Can you tell us a little bit maybe about your backstory? Because we have a lot in common in that we were both pastors. Apparently, you were a pastor and you came out of that, but somehow you're kind of still involved in some of that. Can you give us a kind of an update on where you're at now?
Sure. So I became a pastor, gosh, probably 21, 22 years ago. I actually started out in the Lutheran church and had done my seminary work in a Lutheran church, an ELCA Lutheran church. And my first 5 years of ministry were within that denomination. But then through different experiences, probably a lot of it was self-centered. That was right around the time when Rick Warren came out with that purpose-driven life, and, the whole reality of mega churches and people like Bill Hybels and Rick Warren, Ed Young, where the whole contemporary movement was just really taking up. My ego wanted to be a part of that, and I wanted to be the next one of those guys. And so that and some theological issues and where I saw the Lutheran church going was enough for me to jump and to become connected with the Southern Baptist Convention in Tampa, where I was at the time, and just really took hold of a lot more conservatism because I thought that was going to be a path not only to spiritual prosperity, also then to ministry prosperity. I bought into it hook, line, and sinker. I was that conservative Southern Baptist evangelical guy who conquering the world for Christ.
I say you went the full evangelical route then. So it's a weird switch, isn't it, to go from Lutheran to Southern Baptist. That is a strange move, but sounds like you're saying you did it more out of selfish reasons, not necessarily because you were super convinced of the rightness of the theology or whatever. You saw it as a path to becoming that next Mark Driscoll guy.
It was really both. It was partly, selfish and, dreaming to be a big, hitter and have a mega church on it. But it also was theological issues like, at that time, infant baptism and, the ordination of, homosexuals in the church and all that kind of stuff. At that time, I went from being more progressive to being very conservative, and the Bible being the perfect word of God. I just felt like that in my first 5 years of ministry, I, you know, ran into some challenges. Ministry, basically, it was positioned to me that, hey, the reason why things are going well is because your spiritual life isn't centered, you know, the Word of God, and, you know, you're part of a progressive thing. It's just about the heart of Jesus. And so that, you know, it was, you know, it was deeper than just the selfishness. It was a theological thing as well, that the combination of the two of those things said, hey, you know, while I'm young, I need to make a switch here. And so we did. I mean, we risked it all.
What's strange, though, is that you're kind of describing, in effect, a prosperity gospel, aren't you? It sounds like it's a transactional system. If I'm not centered spiritually, if I'm pursuing the wrong path theologically and biblically, God's not going to bless me. But if I get on the right track, things are going to work out. I'm going to become that next megachurch pastor. I'll be that next Mark Driscoll, Rob Bell, whoever the big name celebrity is. It is a form of prosperity gospel, isn't it? Even though maybe not financially, it's a reward and punishment theology. It sounds like you're describing.
Absolutely. We're ultimately purposed on gaining a reward. You do the sacrifice up front, you know, you pay your dues, so to speak, but ultimately it had the end goal of the prosperity that, you know, you're alluding to there.
It is such an interesting thing, because I think most evangelicals would say they have nothing to do with the prosperity type preachers on TBN and places like that. But I'm convinced that most of them actually do live their lives according to what you just described, essentially a reward and punishment type of system. Where
it's the same.
Yeah,
it's the same.
It really
formula.
Is.
It's the same formula. I do this.
The formula is the same. Exactly. It's a transactional system. And I think a lot of Christians, they live their lives in a rule-based kind of system. It's a strange kind of almost going back to the Old Testament. Just tell me what the rules are. Tell me what I have to do, and God will bless me. And if I'm doing wrong, I'm pretty much going to get punished. And I get that. So you're on this fast track. Sounds like you're going to become the next big Christian celebrity. So did you end up starting a mega church then?
No. What happened was, is we started a very pioneering church actually for the time, and that went well. But then I got offered to come up to this area and pastor another church there, and I did. And, you know, the long story made short is that it just ministry after ministry challenge happened, you know, and I had some health issues come up, and just it all came to a head where just all the things that were going to happen, you know, all the things that are promised in that transactional thing did not take place. You know, for all the praying harder and pressing into Jesus and things that you hear that you're supposed to do and air and doing all kinds of stuff, for all that, it wasn't working. You know, my own personal life wasn't getting any better. You know, the thing about evangelicalism is, you know, all you can do in the system is get better at pretending.
Yeah, put the mask
and faking it. And it wasn't getting any better. And in fact, it was getting worse. And it just, as I describe in the book, you know, there's a big, big moment for me and my family, my marriage, and just my whole entire sense of being, that it literally came to the edge. I mean, it really came to a point of kind of suicidal moment, and a kind of where I was at the end of evangelicalism. And I, you know, took it to as far as it would go, and realized it was just nothing less than a living hell. And it didn't lead to heaven for sure in terms of, you know, experience in the here and now. And that was the beginning of the change for me. That was the beginning of a totally different sense of who Jesus is and what the gospel is. That started a whole, you know, foundation quaking kind of experience for me, where I began to, over the course of time, reevaluate everything I had ever been taught.
So that was, yeah, the beginning of your deconstruction, really, it sounds like, where that cognitive dissonance that you were living with no longer was working for you. Because if you think about it, you look back and say, okay, on the one hand, you're operating under this theological system that says, if I serve God, if I do everything right for God, he will bless me and you'll be a success. You'll be that mega church pastor, that essentially prosperity gospel theology. And yet, not only does it not happen, you're actually suffering, you're struggling. So why wasn't God blessing you? That's the problem, isn't it? So yeah, that's a cognitive dissonance. You're living with two completely conflicting ideas. Something's got to give, though, your mental health or something. It sounds like you just kind of reached the end of your rope.
Yep, that is true. Yep. And, you know, there's a lot that went through that. I mean, I think I've been through just about everything a pastor can be through in terms of ministry. I've, you know, walked through a church split. I've had my life threatened, all kinds of things. And I think it just all came to a head where I just realized, you know, this just, nothing truly ever gets better in the system of faith. It only, you know, you just learn to play better. You just learn to fake it and create this veneer in your life. And you try to believe it, you know, you try to convince. And, you know, it wasn't until I really started to get honest and really see things for how they truly are that I realized that, that there's something that's not adding up here and it's not working.
So, yeah, your cognitive dissonance finally reaches a point where you can't take it anymore because, of course, you could have gone down a couple of different routes at that point. A lot of people will try to ease the uncomfortable feeling of living with that cognitive dissonance by finding another solution, another answer, or doubling down and saying, you know, maybe I'm not working hard enough. Maybe I'm not doing enough for God. Maybe you've got hidden sin in your life. Maybe you're, you know, sneaking around doing something that nobody knows about. And that's, but God knows, of course, he's watching all the time. You can't get away with anything in this system. It's very bad for your mental health. I think a lot of people report that they have huge mental health problems that come out of that sort of a system. You're talking about depression, anxiety, PTSD, suppression of your personality, doubling of your personality. I mean, it's just an unbelievable system. So you've suffered in the system. But what's interesting to me is that you didn't walk away from the whole thing because a lot of us ex-evangelicals have just sacked the whole thing off. We don't want to have anything to do with the church or Christianity or any of that ever again. How did you come to a place where you kind of refined that thinking?
Well, I think part of it was that right during that moment of the end for me, where my life was falling apart, you know, everything that I thought was true was clearly not. I felt like I had, you know, a real encounter with what I would call just pure grace, pure love. And I experienced God as nothing like my father, which was a very conditional relationship, and that set the ball in motion. And it certainly didn't happen overnight. There, as I kind of describe in the book, there are a lot of different experiences, some very supernatural, to be quite honest with you, that continue to drive in me this message that I'm fully acceptable, that God is pure love, and that he has made me whole, pure, without blemish, and that this is something that is irrevocable and irreversible, and there's nothing to do. I mean, there's just everything to believe, and it's unconditional, it's unstoppable, it's just a totally flip side of everything that I had held to be true in terms of my relationship with God. And then, down the road from that, I mean, it didn't all happen at once. I mean, it was several years of process, but down the road from that, I really heard of this message, and, you know, for lack of term, but there are some guys out there, you know, preaching this pure grace message that all is grace, and that grace is, it's God's kindness that leads to people's lives being changed and having a change of mind. And that the Christian life is not about becoming a tomorrow who you are today through performance and sin management, but yet the truth is that the Christian life is a rest. It's your actions catching up with who you already are in Christ, which is, you know, completely sanctified and justified and holy and righteous and pure. And so that I resisted that message for some time. You know, obviously when you're deconstructing, you go through a process of wrestling, but one day it just clicked and I realized, oh my God, that is the truth that my heart has always known was true and was searching for. And it felt like I was breathing for the first time and you go, oh my gosh, this is it. And so that message, really started to sink into me and just push all the butt thing lining up in a way that they had never lined up before. And I thought, oh gosh, this is where it's at. And of course, once that sunk in, then I started to have to really go back to, you know, what is the Bible? What is its authority? Who is Jesus? And really, really rework that. I you know, had a reversal of my heart and mind towards the LGBT community in terms of becoming a fully affirming pastor and person. So all that shifted. And then, you know, about two and a half years ago now, after all that really started to come together, I started writing. I had never really written before, seriously. And I wrote the first real serious article I wrote on my blog was an article titled, What If You're Wrong? A Question for Every Anti-Gay Pastor, Mother, Father. Literally overnight, that article went viral. I mean, really viral.
It just blew up.
And then I started writing seriously. And 2 years later, here I am with a book. You know, a lot of people who are, for some reason, wanting to hear what I have to say.
Right. So you found you're resonating with somebody out there. There's an audience out there. Well, how would you square your views of God now with what you used to have in evangelicalism? Because of all the people I've talked to that have walked away from, let's say, the church or evangelicalism as it's known, I mean, it's obviously a broad movement. It's not a monolith, is it? But there's two things that I've found is, one, they have to revise their views of God. And the second thing is they have to revise their views on the Bible. They can't read it anymore in a literalist sense. So I heard you say both of those things kind of indirectly. You had to go back and rethink what's your relationship with God and what does that look like? How did that look like from where you were when you were a pastor in the Southern Baptist thing?
Oh, it's a complete 180. I mean, you know, it's amazing because every once in a while I run into some old friends from my evangelical days. You know, the way they talk and the things that they say, and, you know, the little
the
phrases that we all said back then, you know.
Oh, the Christianese.
And, you know, when you step out of it, you just look back, you know, oh my God. And I'm not trying to be, you know, like condemning. I'm just, when you start realizing the difference, you just go, oh my God, I can't believe that's who I was. And that's what I believed and how I carried myself as a person. And, you know, the book goes into story after story of just how I destroyed so many lives through my frame of counsel, the messages I gave on stage, just, and my whole relationship aspects of my extended family were so much. It just was so terrible because, you know, when you're evangelical, everybody's a mission, everybody's a project.
Yes.
You know, and God, I mean, I treated people so badly and made them into and used them as someone to,
well, you have to proselytize,
facilitate this Christian dream of mine, and is conservative evangelicalism the Antichrist? I mean, there's so many things about that system of faith, and it's not the, I would say, you know, I like to talk about the system because it really is the system that seduces you, and that the sense of self-improvement and, you know, I can treat God like a vending machine. And if I do this, like you've pointed out, God will do that. And that whole condemnation and shame and guilt and being able to judge other people and recognizing scriptures, you know, to justify, you know, your selfishness and greed and all that kind of stuff that comes with it. But when you step back from it, it's alarming. I mean, I literally, when you look back and go, oh my God, what the hell?
Yeah, was I that guy? Really? It's true, isn't it? I cringe too, because I was a pastor for years, and last year I came across a series of files on my computer that I'd saved from an old laptop and they were a bunch of my sermons from probably 20 years ago. And I thought, I want to see what are these sermon notes. I was cringing. Some of the stuff I said. And it wasn't, well, I wasn't condemning people.
I'll tell you a story.
It was horrifying.
One of the stories in the book is that when I was a pastor of a pretty large Southern Baptist church, one of the members came up and said, hey, you know, I'm going to have a couple friends with me coming up this Sunday. And one of them's a Muslim and the other one is gay. And I just wanted to tell you, pastor, because I just wanted you to know they're going to be there, and, you know, thought, you know, you might be able to somehow, you know, have a message that would be, you know, comfort ever to them. Or and instead of, you know, going that direction in my sermon preparation, I specifically thinking to myself, you know what, I'm going to make sure that person knows that if they don't change their faith, you know, what hell is going to feel like, transition and transform from the homosexuality, what their destination, what that's going to mean to them. And I just, oh my God. And I remember the look that I gave that message, and I remember the look on that person's face as they left the church in terms of, you know, their friends who had come. And you know, I thought I had done my job.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I thought that they, you know, were leaving with their shoulders down and their heads buried to the ground, meant that I had been successful.
You told them the truth, man. That's what you said.
I could tell a thousand stories like that.
I don't think I had anyone that was quite maybe that extreme, where I had a gay person and a Muslim in the same time. You know, you think, okay, here comes the Easter sermon. Here comes the Christmas sermon. You've got a bunch of people that come into your church that never come in the rest of the year. So that's your one chance or two chances maybe in the year to really get them, you know, really convict them with the gospel and all that, to make sure they know where they're going to go if they were to die tonight. What are you going to do when you stand before God? How, you know, he's not going to let you into his heaven and all that kind of stuff. I did all the same things. So yeah, it makes you cringe now looking back on it, doesn't it? Thank God. And yet it's the system that drove us to do. I was only doing that because I'd heard other preachers do it. I thought that's what I was supposed to do. That's what preachers do, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, you lay the gospel on a man, you tell him the truth. And if they're offended by it, well, that's their problem. I remember saying, hey, don't argue with me. I'm not the one who said it. It's in the Bible. God's word says it. So, hey, that's just the truth, man. If you can't handle it, that's your problem. I mean, what an asshole. What a way to live. Yeah. And yet we're pastors of churches, and this is how we're treating people. Unbelievable.
It is unbelievable.
It is. So you got out of the system, but yet you, in a way, you came back around because you still believe in God and Jesus, although it's obviously a completely radically different view. How is it different than what you had as an evangelical, though? What are the differences between that view and your old view?
Well, first of all, when it comes to God, that relationship is unconditional. In fact, in the book, I describe that we really don't have relationships through Jesus. I mean, we don't. It's not a relationship in the classic sense of which we think it is. You know, because the classic relationship is always a give and take. It's always, you know, if I don't do certain things in a relationship, then it suffers, and vice versa. The terminology I discovered is that we have communion with God. You know, that we have a full union that is ours unconditionally. That is like a big deal to me that I can't undo. You know, even my lack of faith is not stronger than God's love for me. You know, even my inability at times to believe or to make the right decision or to respond correctly is not powerful enough to negate God's heart and God's connection with me. The idea of all his grace is a way that communicates that same idea. And so right there, that's just a huge difference. There's, you know, when you realize that you are in an unconditional, always have been. And so that just changes everything right there. When you start from that, then obviously the idea of what it means to be a Christian, what it means to be a person, there can be no more sin management. There can be no more performance. There can be no more, you know, striving and trying to please God, because that's already been a done deal. That's already been established. That's already been, those cards are not in the deck anymore. So you don't have to play games with God in that regard. And so that just sets the table to be a completely different way of thinking about yourself, about God, thinking about your life. And the freedom, Clint, is just, I mean, when I really discovered that I talked about in the book, that I am actually free to sin. You know, I think you don't really have the gospel until you realize you are completely free to sin. And it's in that freedom, and when you become aware that you can do that, it's when that's actually the moment when sin loses its enticement. You know, when you realize, you know what, in the scope of my relationship with God, sin is a non-issue. And you go, oh, God, you know, and there's no condemnation. You know, there's no none of that. Now, you know, is sin going to cost me in my life? You know, is it going to hurt people? Is it going to hurt myself? Absolutely. Does God care about that? Absolutely. But in the scope of my communion with God, in my relationship with God, God is bigger than that. So that disarms the power of sin in my life to be a source of shame and guilt. That's a perpetual cycle. Paul, I think, really got at it in the scripture. He said it's the law that entices us to sin. That message of, you know, hey, don't do it, actually entices you to do it more. So it just starts to really cause you to rethink and reframe so many things that you've been taught, you know, about what your life is and what it means to live in a Christ-like way. You know, I don't do it because I have to. I do it because I get to. So that's just, it's a whole different framework and a whole different way of thinking.
So is that what led you to write this book, Leather Bound Terrorism? Because obviously you're still very critical of evangelicalism, reading through some of your blog posts. You're not a Trump guy. You're not, you're castigating the white evangelical portion of American churches for voting for and supporting Trump and all that. So where does that fit in? How did that lead you to write the book?
Yeah, because I think people need to, I think there's a lot of people. And what I found, you know, having since read the, written the book is that there's a lot of people whose journeys line up very similar to mine. There's a lot of people out there who are feeling and thinking the same things. They might not have the courage right now to live out those convictions or to, you know, to really work through those doubts. But I, you know, that system is evil. That system is darkness. That system is destroying people's lives. My writing is, it's purposed on calling the evils of that conservative evangelicalism out of the shadows. Yeah, that's true. It's purposed on that. I don't write to change people's minds per se. I mean, that has happened, but I don't write to try to change people's minds. Really not my job, but I do write a lot to be, to send a message to the religiously oppressed that they've been heard, that they're loved, and that someone is willing to be a voice where maybe they don't have one, or maybe they don't have the words, maybe they don't have the courage to speak. And so, you know, when I write, I don't write just to communicate what I'm thinking and feeling, but I'm also trying to put words to what other people are experiencing and to be a voice for that. Interestingly enough, I mean, a lot of people have responded to that in a positive way.
Yeah,
but
yet,
I'm highly critical. I mean, who the hell shouldn't be?
Yeah,
this is life-destroying stuff. When you know, 40% of transgender people commit suicide, you know, largely because of religious Christian oppression, someone's got to wake up. Hey, you know, someone's going to have to call this shit out of the darkness. I mean, when you have people's lives, I mean, I just think about all the time I wasted and all the people's lives who that were filled with shame and guilt and condemnation. That, my friend, is a kind of terrorism. That's why I call the book Leather-Bound Terrorism. It's terrorism. That is terrifying. You know, when I had to walk through Calvinism, holy shit, I started to consider that stuff to be true and thinking that, you know what, that God might give me heaven, but might give hell to my son who I love, and he couldn't do anything about it. That is freaking evil at the highest level.
It's monstrous.
And you know, when you see what's happening now in politics and Christianity, and particularly in the United States, you know, at least that's my frame of reference mostly, but in terms of the oppression and how it's played out in racism and homophobia and misogyny and sexism and all that kind of stuff, it's all connected. And that's part of what I try to do in my writing, is help people connect the dots between what they see in church and in conservative evangelicalism and how that's playing out on a worldwide stage and how it's penetrating every social dynamic of our culture. And, you know, a lot of people do want to tone police me. A lot of people say, well, you're just with too broad a brush. And I lose a lot of patience for that, because there are people who are literally dying. There are people who are, you know, curled up in the fetal position of their house right now because they believe this lie that God hates them and that they're unworthy, they're unacceptable just because of who they are. Just to me it just makes me feel like I've got to write, and I've got to help people, to those who have ears to hear, to be able to understand that this is not the heart of God, and this is not the gospel, and this is not Jesus, and there is life, there is grace, there is love, and to try to turn the Titanic around.
Even though it might be sinking.
That's my heart.
It might have already hit that iceberg, Chris. Well, it seems like there's two aspects to this whole thing. I mean, you mentioned the words religious oppression. I think what strikes me right away, I've been doing a lot of research on the connection between evangelicalism and the world of the cults. And one of the things that stands out is that there are pastors and leaders who are busily religiously oppressing their own followers, keeping them in that system, as you say, the sin management and the guilt and the shame and all that. But then those same people, that are listening to those sermons, they're going out into the world and oppressing people, like you said, trans people, LGBTQ people. They're the ones that are committing suicide and being oppressed. So they're having it done to them within the church, and then they're going outside the church and doing it to people out in the world. So it's a double whammy. So it is a monstrously evil system that we need to call it out. And it's it's an amazing system.
And that's, you know, and I just, like I said, I have little patience for people who sit there and go, well, you know, you're just, you know, you use too harsh of words. Well, tell that to the parent who's a transgender child or gay child or black child just committed suicide or was murdered. Yeah, tell it to them that their words are just, you know, too harsh, or they're painting with too big a brush. Just bullshit.
Exactly.
You know, and, you know, I really feel like there's a difference between the voice of the Jesus of the oppressed and the voice of the Jesus who is the oppressor. You know, the people who see Jesus, you know, and use Jesus to oppress, that voice is different than the ones who use Jesus as their voice because they've been oppressed. The tone policing stuff that I get from time to time, you just go, come on, give me a break. You just don't have a clue, really, as to what's going on outside of your little world.
Well, and look at the pushback that we get from evangelicals on places like Twitter and elsewhere, the trolling. I came across one guy the other day that was starting to send some messages to me and some of the other people that I follow on Twitter, some of the ex-evangelicals. And I said to this guy, listen, all you want to do is attack me. You're not listening to anything I'm saying. You're not listening to a word. You don't know anything about me. You don't know my story. I was a pastor. I was a Bible college teacher. I've been there, man. I've done it. So you're not going to convince me, but you're not even listening. All you want to do is just unload on me. And I'm thinking, this is the legacy, isn't it, of what's going on, especially with the ex-evangelical movement. People are leaving the churches and getting out of that system. But evangelicalism doesn't want to acknowledge its role in why they're doing that. They're leaving because of the things you're pointing out and more. And it's especially for women and LGBTQ people. Those are the two most oppressed kind of categories within the church today, I think. And then people of color as well. Is that what you found?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, listen, anybody who they believe differently is an object of war. And, you know, the system is just set up for that. And like you said, it rebirthed itself. Yeah, I remember Jesus in one of his rants that they create children of hell worse than they are.
Exactly. Seven times worse than they are.
So it is a perpetual system. And I know in my transformation, the word I'll use for this moment, that it didn't happen until I was honestly willing to consider that I might be wrong. And, you know, I really stopped debating people. I've really stopped trying to argue with people. And sometimes I'll go back to people and say, listen, until you're at a place where you're really, truly, authentically willing to consider that you might be wrong, and that what you think about God and the Bible and all the other stuff has been misguided or misled, then come to that place before our conversations are going to be helpful. Because, you know, because deflection, you know, is one of the greatest spiritual gifts of conservative evangelicalism. Because I know, because I was like that.
Oh, sure. We all did it. And taught people how to do it. I mean, I hate to say it, but
you've got all your answers.
That's what I mean. People, as a pastor, people come to you and they want answers, and you've got all the pat answers, and you just feed them these answers, and they walk away thinking, yeah, this guy's got it all figured out. I'm sure glad that we're paying this dude to be our pastor. So ironic.
Yeah.
So can you explain the metaphor of the book? What's the leather-bound terrorism? Because from where I'm sitting, it sounds to me like it's using the Bible as a means of terror. Is that the meaning of the metaphor of the book?
Yep. And the subtitle is Crucified by Conservative Evangelicalism, Resurrected by Jesus. And that is leather-bound terrorism. That's exactly what I mean by the title. And, it, you know, people say, oh, that's too strong. Hell no, it's not too strong.
It's not strong enough.
That's
maybe.
The problem, is that you think that that's too strong. That's the problem right now, is that people think that leather-bound terrorism, that title is too strong. If I could make it stronger, I would.
You just couldn't think of a better title.
Because that's been my life. Yeah. And that's what came from me. And I know what's happening in other people's lives. People say, well, you know, gosh, that's just, you know, you're just being too harsh. You're just trying to, you know, clickbait, whatever. I could give a crap less about that. That is reality. You know, when you see it happening in people's lives, when you just get outside your box and you talk to somebody, they've been sent to the curb, and you start listening to people's stories, you go, oh, my God. I mean, there are so many people hurting and just completely doubting and walking away from God completely and, you know, and just doing whatever they can to survive. And you think, oh, my God, this is what we've done. This is what I've done.
Yeah, the church has done that and is doing that. It's unbelievable. And I think, too, if you talk about the angle of the inerrancy, the inspiration piece, because I think that doctrine is a monstrous doctrine in the sense that what it does is it gives people that extra edge to say, well, the reason we need to use the Bible and attack people and beat people down is because it's the Word of God, because it's inspired. It's a sacred book. It's inerrant. It's infallible. And that gives them a supernatural element to the whole argument. And that's why they can go around throwing Bible verses at everybody, and that's going to win their argument and beat people down. And that's basically leather-bound terrorism, isn't it?
You and I both know that the most important element of conservative evangelicalism is control.
Absolutely.
And the number one thing that they use to control is inerrancy. You know, if they don't have sin as being an issue and something that needs to be overcome out of human performance, whether it be faith or faithfulness, some level, and they don't have the inerrancy of the Bible, they have nothing. They have absolutely freaking nothing. That's why they hold on to sin so tightly and hold on to inerrancy so tightly, because if they don't have those two things, then their ability to control and to prosper the institution, a lot of that just completely starts to fall apart. That's why they're so opposed to grace, because grace says that sin has been dealt with and that grace is the man. That if there's anything that's going to deal with sin in your life, it's not condemnation, it's not performance, it's not small groups, it's not to-do steps, it's not pressing into Jesus, praying more, and bearing your head in the Word of God. None of that works. In fact, it makes it worse. It's grace. Okay? So, but they don't like that because you can't control people with that. Okay? You can't control people with grace. Okay? Grace is about freedom, not control. The other thing is you can't control people when the main authority of their life is the mind of Christ within them. It's not a Bible. It's not words on a page. It's actually the mind of Christ that they have on their own with them that is going to, with the Spirit, guide them in all truth. You can't control people with that. Okay? So the whole idea of the sin and the importance of sin, and we got to rebuke it, we got to condemn it, we got to speak to it, that's an issue of control. The whole issue of inherency of the Bible, the reason why they hold on to it, is all control. We got to keep people assimilated into the evangelical Borg. Because if you really want to set people free, you speak grace into their life. If you really want to set people free, you tell them that you have everything within you. You have the freaking mind of Christ within you to discern and understand all truth and be on this personal journey that is uniquely your own of faith, in which you get to experience and encounter God in your own way. You set them free.
It's too liberal. It's too way out there, Chris. And that's exactly right, isn't it? The ultimate irony that churches are actually enslaving and controlling people rather than setting them free, which is what they say they stand for, though. We're all about freedom. We're all about setting people free in Christ. No, you're not. You're about controlling people, as you say, enslaving them, religiously oppressing them, causing all kinds of religious trauma and all these other psychological symptoms that people have. And then they have to go out and you know, get therapy and counseling to deal with it. Crazy.
Well, the worst thing that could happen to a Stephen Furtick or a Ed Young or, you know, a Mark Driscoll or any big cats is if their people found out they don't freaking need church.
Yeah,
they don't
absolutely.
Need to tithe. They don't need to come on Sunday. They don't need small groups. They don't need anybody to interpret. They don't need that. Now, all of a sudden, you know, the system starts to implode.
Yeah, breaks
you know,
down.
If you can't get, you know, the whole thing about, if you ever went to an Elevation service, which I have on several occasions in Stephen Furtick here in the United States, I mean, it's all about sin management, improving your life, getting revved up to try harder, go at it again this next week, five more steps, five more principles to the good life. Here's what you got to do next. And it is an addiction. It is a spiritual cocktail of law and partnering with Jesus to improve your life that can only end up in one place, and that is it really doesn't get any better.
And in fact, it gets worse, doesn't
it? People are addicted.
You know, you're absolutely right. This is something I talked about with Andrew Jasko a few months ago. That's exactly what it is. It's a cycle of obsessive religious addiction because, as you say, they hype you up. The whole service is a giant entertainment system, and you can't fault it on a purely entertainment level. It's incredibly professional. The lighting, the music, the musicians are world class. I mean, the whole performance is amazing. And it manipulates people with the music, and the sermon is powerful, and they're wonderful communicators. But yet, when you break it down, as you say, what it is it boils down to, you didn't succeed this last week, but yeah, we're going to rev you up. We're going to send you out into the world. And next week, though, you're going to come back and do it all over again. And it's like a drug. You've got to keep coming back every Sunday to get your fix. And yet somehow, like any drug, it never seems, you know, It kind of works a little bit, but the longer it goes, the less effective it really becomes, but the harder you have to try to get there, and you never seem to get there. You're always disappointing God and disappointing your fellow Christian.
Yeah, you just get better at putting on the veneer of, I'm walking with my Bible, I got my small group, I got all this stuff looking good for me.
Yeah.
And really, you know, Clint, as you probably would, you know, agree with that, it really is the ultimate enticement of the flesh. Because the flesh, to me, as Paul talked about, really is not this immoral impulse within you. And you've got, you know, Jesus inside of you and Satan inside of you. They're both in battle with you, this duality thing. To me, the flesh is this enticement to ourselves for that which we already have in Christ. And in my mind and heart, we have everything already. You can't get any closer to God than you are now. You can't get anything more of Jesus than you have now. You can't get any better than you are now. You are a new creation. And that word there in Greek, it actually means you're a new species. The intention of the flesh is to go outside of that revelation, making a name for yourself, that you did something that was part of why you are a contributing factor to your success. That's the heart of evil, that enticement of flesh, and man, evangelicalism loves it. This idea that I can partner with Jesus to become this and do this and be this, and it's so enticing. You know, it's addicting. The American dream spiritual form.
It's the American dream, but we've somehow repackaged it. Well, co-opted Jesus for our own ends, haven't we? We've turned him into something that maybe he isn't, but yet, man, is it sure big business. You know, those big mega churches out there like Stephen Furtick's and Mark Driscoll and all these other guys, man, multi-million dollar businesses.
Sin is big business.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
And if you can keep people coming back every week and bring a friend next week, you know, they'll get you into that system as well.
Yeah.
Hook you in. And again, I mean, these are, I keep coming back to this thing of the tactics that a lot of these evangelical churches use are right out of cults playbooks. These are exactly what you were talking about earlier about control. You know, every cult promises its followers something that only the cult or only the leader can deliver. And this is essentially the same what you just described, isn't it? You could strip away all the language and you're describing a cult, basically, or the cult playbook. It's the same exact tactics, and that's how they keep you, they indoctrinate you. And the fear is if you leave, you're going to lose your salvation. You're going to lose something that only we can give you, only God can give you. So, yeah, they control people through fear, even keeping them staying within the system. So, yeah, it's an addictive cycle. And it's big business, as you said. Man, is it ever big business?
I talk with a lot of people. It's very hard because when you start to step outside that world, you feel a nakedness. You feel dirty. Such a seed of condemnation and sown that in so many threads of our lives that when you start to step out of it, you do feel. I mean, that's the part of the power of that, you do feel like you're betraying God. You know, people who are trying to walk away and come out from underneath this thing, it's a complicated process, you know, for people.
And very difficult. A lot of people never do.
That's why I write, you know, is to encourage, you know, to say, listen, somebody gets it and been there and done that and is doing it, and you're not alone.
You're not crazy.
A lot of, I mean, it's to me that a lot of people I talk to don't realize that there's a lot of people who are walking this out, you know, alongside of them. They think they're the only one, or they think that, man, something's wrong with me, and they feel isolated, and, you know, and then when they start to realize, oh my God, I'm not the only one who's feeling like this, and that there are people out there who are putting words to what I've been feeling. Number one feedback I get from my writing, and particularly this book, is the idea that, thank God, someone's finally put words to what I've been thinking and feeling all along.
Well, it's very validating, isn't it? I mean, it's the same reason why I do this podcast, is because what people say, absolutely, the same exact thing is, they say, you're putting words to what I've been thinking or feeling or you know, talking to other people about, and it validates my experience. So I'm not crazy. We're not alone in this thing. There's thousands and millions of people, maybe, I don't know how many out there, that are thinking this stuff. So hopefully we can connect even more people to your writings and what you're talking about.
Well, and you know, that's the other thing, and this is kind of a little sub thing, and it's kind of, I mean, I'm not going to make it my soapbox, but I certainly am going to address it. And then I get really pissed off when I find in progressive circles, and by that I mean the people who should know better. I mean, we're trying to, you know, help awaken folks to this and, you know, help people to see the forest from the trees in terms of these evil systems of believing and so forth. And yet I found some folks within that circle to be so freaking territorial. They carve out this niche, and anybody who gets in their little area or starts gaining attention of their little audience, I just think to myself, man, we have got to start realizing that on our side of this whole issue, we need all the freaking voices we can get. And we need to not be trying to carve out territory and make our own little progressive empires and get our own little followings and live in our own little isolated worlds. If this tide is going to turn around, it's because we have broken the mold that often happens in ministry, where people get into this empire building and be willing to honor and work freaking together and to honor each other's voices instead of being intimidated by them. I know that's a little theme, but that really does, because I've had it happen to me. You know, when I first started getting attention, and I didn't intend to, this all happened to me without trying. There were a couple of progressive big name people who wanted to, I mean, they basically tried to undermine, you know, my voice because it was starting to attract their own followers. And I thought, oh my God, here we go again. I thought, man,
thought we got away from all this.
You know, maybe it was my naivete, but I thought, you know, gosh, you would think that people on this side of the fence would feel differently, but some people don't.
But it's human nature, isn't it? We're very territorial. Even if we've carved out something really cool and amazing, someone else starts encroaching on our turf, man, we're going to kick them out of there. So it sounds like that's what's happened to you. It's a shame that we can't work together to kind of get the word out there. Who cares if we got the same audience or we have an overlap in the audience? If we're talking about something that's setting people free, what's wrong with that? I don't know. It's too threatening, I guess.
It is human nature, and I understand that.
Yeah,
but I just kind of cringe a little bit when I see that. And it's happened to me not really recently. It was back when I started, but I see it happen to other people. And so when I run into some people who are team players and want to lift each other's voices up, I think, man, now that's awesome.
That's refreshing.
You know, I want to be a part of that, and I would love to see more of that.
Well, I'm aware of the time. I don't want to keep you too long, but I'm curious as to know, what are you doing nowadays? What are you doing? Are you pastoring a church anywhere? Are you away from all that now besides doing your writing? Where are you headed as far as, you know, spiritually?
Well, right now, I don't pastor what what's happened to me is that my online stuff and everything I do with writing has really taken on a life of its own, which is kind of cool. So I have a full-time job outside of all that, but in my free time, I really devote a lot of attention to that. The book is out and doing very well. And so, spending a lot of time just nursing that along. And, but there's a lot of people who reach out to me. And so I spend a lot of time, you know, being, quote, kind of a pastor to all those people. So I guess church has switched from a local kind of expression to a social media and otherwise expression for me.
That is a very ironic thing.
Maybe one day I'll get back into the church world. I haven't ruled it out. I've had, you know, several opportunities to do that. Nothing's, you know, come up in terms of, you know, a real good fit yet. But that doesn't mean that won't happen and I won't go back into that. But right now, I love the online, you know, connecting with people and having conversations and phone calls and Skype sessions and, you know, exchanges back and forth.
It's good to connect with new people all the time. That's what social media has done, I guess, for me too, is meeting people like you and all kinds of other people that I've met through doing the podcast and on Twitter and Facebook and other groups that I'm a part of. And it's funny, like you say, it's an interesting, ironic thing that here we are, ex-pastors. We're still pastoring, though. In a way, my podcast, your writing and the interactions we have with people online and in different places on social media, we're still counseling people, helping people. I'm doing all the same things I was doing, I guess, when I was a pastor, but I'm certainly not giving the same message out. That's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, right now, I mean, I'm reaching more people, tons more people than I ever did.
Absolutely.
You know, just locally in a church.
And it's a completely different message. Well, speaking of social media, how can people get a hold of you and how can they find your book? What's the best way to get a hold of you?
Yeah, so Letterbound Terrorism is available on Amazon only. So it's exclusively through Amazon. I think you can pick it up at Barnes & Noble on the website as well. And then, of course, they can find my blog at Chris Kratzer, ChrisKratzer.com. And then I'm on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And you can kind of look me up there. Those are probably the best ways to connect with me.
So if you have any questions or thoughts for Chris, after picking up a copy of Leatherbound Terrorism, there's a bunch of ways you can get a hold of Chris. Listen, man, this has been great. I don't want to keep you too long, but I've had a great time chatting with you. There's definitely a resonance here. I mean, I can feel your pain. You know, I was laughing and cringing at the same time when you were telling those stories about when you were a pastor, because it made me think of some of the cringy things that I did and said or that happened to me.
Yeah.
You know, so I think we got a you're definitely a kindred spirit, man. No doubt about it. I don't want to keep you too long, Chris, so I'll let you go, man. Thank you so much for chatting with me. It's been a really interesting conversation.
Hey, thank you, Clint, for the opportunity, man. Love you and appreciate your ministry and your work.
I don't know about you, but I hope you enjoyed getting to know Chris Kratzer as much as I did in this time of chatting with him about where he's coming from. I find it absolutely fascinating, as I said before, to find people like him who have not just only walked away from the church, but haven't really abandoned Christianity full stop, like so many of us ex-evangelicals have done. You know, I think there's that tendency, and we mentioned it in other shows before, to kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater. And that leads a lot of us to wonder, was there ever a baby in the bathwater at all? Or were we in the wrong bathtub and all the rest of it? And in fact, if you've been listening, the one episode I did a couple weeks ago, which was about evangelicalism and the world of the cults, showing that there's connections between the way a lot of conservative evangelical churches operate and the actual world of mainstream recognized cults. And this is something that Chris and I touched on this episode as well, this issue of control. And I think the problem is that so many people have been burned in the system and scorched. And even Chris says, hey, I was contemplating suicide. That's how bad the depression, the anxiety were, even as a pastor, when everything was supposed to be going so well. And where's all the promises of God? Where was that mega church that I thought I was going to land, I was going to start?
by doing all the things right, by being a faithful servant of God, according to all the conservative evangelical sort of prosperity gospel theology. And it was all a bunch of bullshit. And not only was it bullshit, it actually led him to near suicide. And that's pretty dark. That's a real dark place, isn't it? And so yet he didn't turn away from the whole thing. He's come to some completely new, reworked understanding of the Bible and God and Jesus. And I don't know about you, but it's interesting to me to figure out how he was able to do that. And I don't know how that resonates with you or where you're at. I can understand some people might be turned off by that message and want nothing to do with any of it because it's all tainted with that broad brush of the conservative evangelical movement and its close ties to the political right. In terms of the 81% white evangelical Trump voting, Trump supporting base, and all the partisan lines and all that stuff that's come down the pipeline. And so it's been so tainted with the political arena that for most people who walked away from it all for whatever reason, I don't know, maybe you walked away from it all. I don't know why, but you don't want to have anything to do with God, anything to do with Jesus because of that association. And so maybe Chris is offering a way forward here. If you're still kind of wanting to understand or unpack this relationship with God and Jesus, but do it in a more inclusive, open, and affirming way, then leather band terrorism is going to be something that you're probably going to want to take a look at. So I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Chris. So what's coming up in the next few weeks? Well, I've still got interviews in the pipeline, but I'm going back to my focus on connecting evangelicalism and the world of the cults. I've got some phenomenal interviews lined up along those lines. I'm going to be talking with Rick Ross, who's a cult expert. He's got a website called culteducation.com with incredible resources. I'm also going to be talking to Dr. Stephen Hassan. I mentioned him in the episode last one 2 weeks ago. He's the one that developed the BITE model of how cults control their followers. I'm going to be talking to him. I've also had a conversation with a woman in Melbourne in Australia. She is an ex-Jehovah's Witness. And so we're going to be talking to her and she's putting me in touch with some other ex-cult members as well in different places. And so I've got some fantastic stuff in the pipeline. I want to continue to explore this thing about not just evangelicalism, but cults in general and talk to ex-cult members. So if you know someone who is an ex-cultist, someone who walked away from any type of cult, let them know that I'm interested in talking to them. Probably the best way to contact me is to follow me on Twitter. You can find me there at MindShift2018. You can also take a look on Facebook for the MindShift Podcast Facebook page and get a hold of me that way too. So that would be a couple of good ways to get a hold of me. You can also take a look in the show notes for my contact information. So I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Chris Kratzer. Thanks for joining me in my scratchy, cold voice. And we'll catch you in 2 weeks. Remember, every episode now is coming out every 2 weeks, not every week like I used to do. But I will be bringing you an episode in 2 weeks. We're going to be refocusing, as I say, back on the world of the cult. So this gives me a couple of weeks to prepare a fantastic episode. So join me again right here on Mindshift Podcast. Yes,